Hello, everyone. I'm sure you've seen the news that the border dispute between Thailand and Cambodia that has been simmering away for the last few months has quite dramatically escalated. I'm recording this on the 24th of July after the news of F-16s being deployed and other reports of shelling by Cambodia into Thailand leading to civilian casualties. So this is a troubling time, and I mean, this podcast is not really a news podcast, but given that I'd recently worked on some of the historical context of the relations between Thailand and Cambodia in the 20th century for a Patreon bonus episode, I thought I'd kind of revisit that and perhaps plug a little bit of the historical hole here, because there will no doubt be plenty of coverage of this from news outlets around the world. But if we look at this article I've got here from the New York Times, which is ostensibly about the history of the border conflict, well, there is a little bit missing, just about 100 years or so from 2008 to 1907. So I think there are some important pieces of context around all of this stuff, you know, in that century and prior to it. So this is a little bit hastily put together, but I basically just want to give you a bit of a longer view of what is going on right now, because it's going on right now. So I'm also hoping to have an expert on the podcast very soon to talk about this same topic. So think of this more as like a precursor to that. So we're going to start this little history lesson at around 900 CE. At this time, Cambodia was under the reign of King Yasovarman I. He was the ruler that moved the capital from Hariharalara to Yasodharapura, which is where Angkor will be based and basically the center of the Khmer Empire for the next 500 years or so. He builds Phnom Bakeng, a personal favorite, and lays the foundations for other staples of this period. So we get the large sort of manufactured lakes, the Barai, and we get temple mountains, or, you know, temples built on top of mountains like Phnom Bakeng. But according to David Chandler, the ruler that was called the Leper King also ordered the construction of temples on mountains further away from this new capital. One was built on a natural hill on what will one day be the boundaries between Cambodia and Thailand. Its name is Priya Vihear. Now, I should say that is what Chandler says in History of Cambodia, but I've seen other sources state that it was built under the reign of Suryavarman I or II. Either way, we're talking about around 1,000 years ago. And if it matters, which maybe it does, we are talking about the rulers of the Khmer Empire building these temples. Now, although it's not an exact way of putting these things, we could say that back then, that whole area, which is now Thailand, was occupied by something that resembles the Khmer Empire. Whether these words exactly make sense in that context is perhaps debatable by some archaeologists, but generally speaking, if you look at the maps where this territory or where this culture's reach was, then the Khmer were the dominant civilization in this space. But as we well know, that power faded, and one major reason for that was the rise of the proto-Siamese peoples to rival the Khmer, and by the mid-1400s, there are regular invasions coming from the west, and this and a few other economic and geopolitical reasons actually caused the Khmer civilization to move their center of power away from the outskirts of the Tonle Sap down toward the confluence of the Mekong and Tonle Sap rivers, where modern-day Phnom Penh is. In the centuries that follow, and this was around the period where Cambodia was in a much weaker way and about to have about half a century of being dominated by either the Siamese or the Vietnamese, and again, it's a vast oversimplification here, but generally speaking, the Vietnamese, due to a few cultural differences, are seen as more threatening to the Khmer than the Thai are. But that certainly doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of animosity between these two peoples either. It's just that they had this longer period of sort of overlapping and being integrated, and that simply wasn't the case between, say, the Khmer and the Vietnamese. But the short story is, Cambodians were always worried that either of these two more powerful neighbours could simply swallow them up. It's also kind of helpful for these periods in, you know, the latter medieval period kind of time to more or less, you know, let's let go of the strict idea of national boundaries that we're used to and think of these districts that, you know, are now, you know, provinces and states of Cambodia. Let's think of them being slightly more fluid, with people sharing cultural characteristics, as I mentioned before, and perhaps they're pledging loyalty to their local rulers or kings, but again, it's just not quite as rigid as we might assume today. Like, if you ask someone living in what is now one of these border areas 1,000 years ago what country they were living in, well, you're really just not going to get any kind of answer that makes sense there, right? It's just, these are vastly different time periods. But that being said, one of the things that did hold a kind of proto-nationalistic importance, especially to the monarchs of Cambodia, was the link to the temple complex of the Angkorian kingdom. Like, even though they weren't basing their capital there anymore, they remained conscious of these temples, particularly Angkor Wat, and they were never lost, as some people tend to assume. They were important in tracing their own links to sovereignty and the monarchy generally. And it was a tough time because Cambodian monarchs were usually going to one of these more powerful neighbors to help them come to power. And in return, they would, you know, pledge loyalty to that side, and Cambodia would often be managed by either Thailand or Siamese or Vietnamese for periods from around 1700 to 1850. But an important moment in all of this history comes in 1794. That is when even, you know, we're getting to a more modern idea of what the Cambodian territory would end up being. But in 1794, these areas, including modern-day Battambang and Siem Reap, so in the northwest generally, and including Angkor, they were annexed by the Siamese under Rama I. But they weren't just seized and held outright. They were kind of given to a Cambodian ruler, installed by Siam, and that kind of encapsulates how the relationship between the Khmer and the Siamese was functioning for a long time and at various periods. So Cambodian territory was often taken by its neighbours. Cambodian rulers would struggle to retain control or legitimacy, but there were also periods of cooperation, and that's a theme that will come up again and again, tension and collaboration, sort of side by side. And importantly, the Vietnamese factor very much into the, you know, balance of power in the eyes of the Siamese, and Cambodia sort of stuck in between that geographically, naturally becomes this sort of buoyancy that sort of goes with the tide. And again, I just want to stress here that the border areas have shifted a lot over time, and they're deeply, you know, tied to national pride for both Cambodians and Thais, but for much of their history, they're just a bit more fluid than we might imagine today. But that does tend to change as we get toward modern history, and these border lines become more certain. So let's move forward a little bit to around the mid-1800s. This is when Cambodia, under King Duang, who was a Thai-sponsored monarch that spent most of his childhood in Thailand, or Siam, he was sort of the head of a new independent or semi-independent Cambodia, and it was just after the Vietnamese withdrawal, after a significant period of almost like quasi-colonization of a large part of Cambodian territory under Vietnamese emperors, and that sort of pushed back and eventually defeated by a Thai invasion, and they install their monarch, who then oversees this period, as I said, of semi-independent Cambodia once again. And it's almost like a mini golden age. It's a renaissance for sort of Khmer culture and Theravada Buddhism and things like that. And But King Duong was still subordinate to the Siamese. But when French colonialism arrived in Indochina, that shifted the dynamic. Duong's successor, King Norodom of the Norodom family, saw the French replace the Siamese as Cambodia's external protector. For Norodom, this wasn't just about modernization, it was a political move. He was trying to break out of centuries of semi-dependence on Thailand or Vietnam, both of whom had meddled constantly in Cambodian succession, borders, and sovereignty, as we've seen. And then we get to a very important year, 1907. So this is after Indochina has become French Indochina, and it's actually where the New York Times article I referenced before sort of begins its history of things, but I think the extra background helps. But in that year, 1907, Battambang and Siem Reap, and with them Angkor, were formally returned to Cambodian territory under a Franco-Siamese treaty. The borders were also mapped and formalized during this period, and that's very important for the story. But as you can tell, we're in the period of French colonialism. This is French Indochina. Now, this treaty, which brought back Battambang and Siem Reap back into Cambodian territory, this is seen as like a defining moment in the reign of King Sisawat, even though he didn't really negotiate it. But symbolically, this is a really big deal because, as we know, Angkor isn't just a set of ruins. It was the physical representation of Cambodia's past power, glory, and sovereignty. It's very much tied to the royal sort of lineage as well. And this helps explain why things like Priya Vihear still matter so much. Now, this will come up again, but when the French officials draw up that map that's agreed to in 1907, obviously using pretty basic surveying techniques, nowhere near as precise as what we have today, Priya Vihear, this temple, was placed on the Cambodian side of the border. Importantly, the Siamese side accepted this map and signed the treaty. Maybe they didn't notice that deal, but maybe they didn't care at the time, but the agreement laid the foundation for more than a century of occasional conflict, which is what we're seeing right now. But, well before this, for instance, during the Second World War, Thailand, now having officially renamed from Siam, sided with Imperial Japan and launched the Franco-Thai War. They took advantage of French weakness and invaded parts of Cambodia and Laos, once again claiming Battambang and Siem Reap. Japan ended up mediating the peace process there. And this is an era that the historian Milton Osborne describes sort of as quite indicative of Thailand's ability to bend with the wind. They aligned with Japan, sensing the French colonial order was collapsing, but they were also careful. They didn't send major combat troops alongside the Japanese, but they sided with the Japanese. But when the war ended, they hadn't really tarnished their reputation enough to make them look too bad. Their record was seen as clean enough for them to sort of join in with the United Nations quite early in 1946. But key to that was they had to return Battambang and Siem Reap to the French again. But it just goes to show that these regions have changed hands quite a lot. Less than a decade later, Cambodia, along with the rest of French Indochina, had gained independence following the war. And right around that same time, Thai forces moved into Priya Vihear, essentially occupying it. Their logic, I mean, perhaps the logic was something like, well, the French drew the map, the French are gone. Why don't we just take it back? You know what I mean? Like, well, maybe the borders are all a little bit more loosey-goosey now that the French are gone. And to be fair, from Cambodia's perspective, they had a lot of territorial grievances as well. Like, Prince Sihanouk is often, you know, openly asking, like, what about Kampuchea Krom? Maybe, You know that area around the Mekong Delta and Saigon, which had been annexed by the Vietnamese in the 1800s? Maybe that should be reincorporated into Cambodia, you know? What's up with these borders? This was after a period, you know, this was after the first Indochina War. Years of war, with guerrilla bases across the Cambodian and Vietnamese border. We could also talk about the Khmer Issarak that were on the Thai border as well. So exactly where the lines were drawn were being messed with constantly, and this only got worse after the First Indochina War as well, when we start talking about, you know, the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese armies that are using Laotian and Cambodian territory. So for someone like Sihanouk, who's trying to remain neutral in, you know, the era leading up to the Second Indochina War, he's really anxious about the borders because they've been messed with constantly, and his anxiety isn't limited just to the border with Vietnam, but also with Thailand. I know it's come up in the podcast every now and again, but it might have gone under the radar, but Sihanouk was really obsessed with this issue. Like, this was the thing that if he was ever at a conference or speaking at some kind of international relations event, the number one thing for him was securing Cambodia's borders. He was always trying to go to another country and just be basically like, hey, can you recognize our territorial borders? As long as we can start getting international recognition, perhaps we can stop our neighbors from nibbling away at the edges and secure this territory in the long term. And again, it just points to that anxiety running pretty deep. It's fair to say that this fear of territorial loss is kind of baked in to the Khmer worldview. And it's also kind of interesting to consider how important it was that Sihanouk was taking up this task. He knew how important it was, not just for himself, but for his popularity to be seen as someone that could protect the border, something that still hasn't gone away. So when Thai troops occupied Priya Vihear in the 1950s, and even started claiming it as part of their national heritage, Sihanouk took them to the International Court of Justice. And in 1962, the court issued its ruling in favour of Cambodia. And what was the argument? Well, it came down to those early 20th century maps. Back in 1904, France and Siam had agreed that their shared border would follow the natural watershed, basically the ridgeline of the Dangrek Mountains. But when the French produced a map a few years later, Priya Vihear appeared on the Cambodian side of the border. Technically, that map didn't follow the watershed rule. It was a mistake, or at least an inconsistency. Thailand argued that the map was invalid, that it had never been officially approved, and Cambodia responded by pointing out that for decades, Thailand had treated the map as accurate. It had been used in schools, in government documents, and no one had protested when Cambodian officials visited the temple. There had been a tacit acceptance. So, the ICJ ruled in Cambodia's favour, even if the map wasn't perfect. Thailand had accepted it for too long to reverse course now. The temple, they ruled, belonged to Cambodia. Thailand pulled back its troops, but the ruling has remained controversial ever since, and it's still very much at the heart of today's tensions. It was in the 60s and 70s that, as we know, the region fell back into war, first in Laos, then Vietnam, and finally Cambodia. Thailand, though, was able to avoid getting dragged directly into the conflict. It remained under a conservative government, a constitutional monarchy with a strong military contingent, who were more than happy to stage a coup whenever they felt like it. But during the Cold War, they fully aligned with the United States and used that alliance as a way to protect themselves from what they saw as the threat of communist expansion. The US built massive air bases in Thailand, which became launch pads for bombing missions not just over Vietnam, but also Cambodia and Laos. Thailand basically became the logistical backbone of the American war effort in Southeast Asia. Troops rotated through, intelligence operations were run out of Bangkok, and US military aid flowed in steadily. Now, that doesn't mean Thailand had no Cold War troubles of its own. There was a Communist Party of Thailand, mostly based in the rural northeast, and it had links to China and North Vietnam as well, but it never posed a serious threat to the central government. In the late 1960s, Thailand even had a brief experiment with parliamentary democracy, but that ended in 1971 with another military coup. By then, a new generation of young, educated, middle-class Thais were starting to demand change. In 1973, student protests exploded, to the extent that the military government was forced to resign. The hated leader, Field Marshal Thanom Kittikachorn, went into exile. But the political mood flipped again in 1975, when Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia all fell to communism. That caused a wave of fear in Thailand. Suddenly, the idea that we might be next didn't seem so far-fetched. In 1976, when Thanom suddenly returned to Thailand, students protested again. Tens of thousands gathered at Thammasat University in Bangkok, calling for democracy and warning against a return to military rule. But the right-wing media painted them as communists and traitors. Public anger was stirred up and tensions built rapidly. Then, on the morning of October 6th, 1976, security forces and armed right-wing vigilantes surrounded the campus and launched a brutal crackdown. It ended in a massacre, one of the darkest days in modern Thai history. And there's a grim parallel here, because it was at the very same time this was happening in Thailand, Cambodia, or the Democratic Kampuchea, the Khmer Rouge regime, were executing their own students as well, not for being communists, but for being suspected enemies of communism. Now, I sort of bring this up like I realize that it's veering away from the border dispute stuff, but I just bring it up as a point of making the point, rather, that the region must be thought of as an interacting sort of piece, that these the politics of one and what happens in another is influencing the rest of the region. Now, what's often forgotten is that during this time, even under the Khmer Rouge, the Prea Vihear issue didn't go away. The Khmer Rouge, like they did with Vietnam, made claims on Thai territory as well. There were occasional cross-border raids and some firefights. Thai forces sometimes pushed back and made their own incursions into Democratic Kampuchea. But both sides seemed careful not to let things escalate into open war. But still, the Khmer Rouge were deeply suspicious of Thailand. It was firmly in the US camp, and the regime in Phnom Penh viewed it as a potential hub for spies and traitors, something they already believed was happening everywhere inside Cambodia. Prea Vihear, in particular, was seen as a potential flashpoint. One high-ranking Khmer Rouge cadre, Chut Chet, was later arrested and executed. He confessed to being involved in a plot, one that supposedly involved defectors in Thailand and a Thai army invasion of Cambodia, starting in the Prea Vihear region. Now, you'd think that after the Thammasat massacre and Thailand's return to military rule in 1976, that the Thai government would take a hard line against the Khmer Rouge. But, interestingly, the opposite happened. They started trying to build a working relationship, eventually. As Vietnam's war with Democratic Kampuchea escalated, both the Khmer Rouge and their backers in China began reaching out to Thailand and the ASEAN bloc, trying to present themselves as a counterweight to Vietnam's regional dominance. But, by that time, Democratic Kampuchea didn't have much time left. When Vietnam invaded Cambodia in 1978 and overthrew the Khmer Rouge, it created big problems for Thailand. Now, right on their border, was a new Vietnamese-backed government. Thailand was worried, especially since Vietnam already had strong ties with Laos as well. So, in the 1980s, Thailand became a key base for the anti-Vietnamese resistance. Refugee camps were set up along the border, though sadly some refugees were actually forced back into Cambodia. Thailand also allowed various Cambodian rebel groups to operate from its territory, including non-communist ones like Phun Sen Pek and the KPNLF, but these were also a cover for the Khmer Rouge, though Thailand didn't officially support them. Thailand helped keep the resistance going, letting weapons, supplies, and support flow through its land, all part of the broader Cold War effort by the US and China to counter Vietnam's influence in the region as part of the larger Sino-Soviet split. There were even border clashes between Vietnamese troops and Thai forces, usually when the Vietnamese crossed over in pursuit of Khmer Rouge guerrillas. These raids sometimes led to direct firefights, and while neither side wanted a full-scale war, the tension was very real. After the Cold War started to wind down and Vietnam finally withdrew from Cambodia in 1989, you might think things would settle down along the Thai-Cambodian border. And yes, they kind of did. The days of jungle warfare, rebel bases, and Cold War geopolitics playing out in the Dang Grek Mountains were almost at an end. But that didn't mean the border suddenly became peaceful. Throughout the 1990s, Thailand's relationship with Cambodia was shaped by two things: business and politics. On one hand, there was a growing interest in trade, investment, timber, and cross-border smuggling, the unglamorous kind of post-conflict normalization. On the other hand, there were deep suspicions between the two countries that never really went away. Of course, there was still the issue of the Khmer Rouge, who, even after the Vietnamese had left, remained in their enclaves near the Thai border, making their money and eventually harassing the government in Phnom Penh when peace talks, even the UNTAC era, eventually failed. Many of them stayed holed up in the border areas, places like An Long Veng, which is not that far from Prea Vihear. And we all know about their use of mines and other anti-personnel weapons, many of which are still embedded in the ground and perhaps even responsible for the injuring of a Thai soldier in this recent conflict. But back in the 90s, for a while the Khmer Rouge were tolerated, even used by Thai military and business interests, mostly to secure timber and gem routes. It was a murky, cynical kind of relationship, one that sometimes gets swept under the rug in official histories, but it definitely happened, and it kept the border unstable well into the 1990s. Meanwhile, the border itself remained poorly demarcated. The maps were vague, colonial-era artifacts, and even as Cambodia began to stabilize under Hun Sen, and Thailand moved toward a booming economy and political reform, at least until the market crashed in 97, and there's been instability off and on since then, but still a rising tide, there was this ever-present issue. Who owns what along the border? Where does Thailand end and Cambodia begin? And at what points along that border would this issue arise? In 2003, things flared up again, but it wasn't a military clash. This time it was a rumour, sparked by a quote from a Thai actress, supposedly claiming that Angkor Wat belonged to Thailand. Now, whether she actually said it or not doesn't matter. Riots broke out in Phnom Penh. The Thai embassy was torched, and dozens of Thai businesses were attacked. Thailand evacuated its citizens overnight, and it was just a reminder that history didn't end just because the wars had. By the mid-2000s, it was clear that one spot in particular would keep coming back into the picture, Prea Vihear. Even though the International Criminal Court had awarded it to Cambodia back in 1962, the area around the temple was still contested. And when Cambodia applied to have it listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2008, Thailand erupted. Nationalists in Bangkok accused the government of selling out Thai land. There were protests, and then troops on both sides were deployed to the border. For the next few years, basically from 2008 to 2011, the Prea Vihear area was the site of multiple standoffs, clashes, and even artillery exchanges. Soldiers died, civilians were evacuated, much like what we are seeing today. I found an article from 2011 that was celebrating the restoration of friendly relations between the two countries. And how? With a football match between the Thai ruling party and Cambodian government officials. Hun Sen led his team to a 10-7 victory in front of nearly 50,000 spectators. I hope that football diplomacy can find a solution to this current conflict as well. Because the Prea Vihear clashes, much like the spectacle of Hun Sen scoring a goal, has become a bit of a stage. It's become a useful lever to pull for either government when they might need something like that. Some barbed wire to go up, some tanks that you can tell off for parking too far into a boundary. Even civilians engaging in a little too much nationalistic fervour at the temple, being a bit too verbose. But perhaps this is just like leaving a box of matches out And, you know, you can't be surprised when eventually, inevitably, a fire starts. Now, we're seeing artillery fire. We're seeing civilian and military casualties and even airstrikes, which is new. It's really not good. And although I doubt that it will become a full-scale war, if it did, it would be, to borrow a line from a tweet by Sebastian Strangio predicting this whole thing months ago, this would possibly be the stupidest war ever. Now, I won't go too deep into guessing what might be really happening behind the scenes in Bangkok or Phnom Penh. I think there are some reasons why both governments might have started this and continue to use it. This bit of nationalist noise to score points or distract or to serve some other political end, but whether anyone meant for it to get this far, who knows, and perhaps there's too much pride on the line now to back down. Let's just hope no one else gets hurt. This region doesn't need any more war. But I hope this little history lesson has filled you in on just how far back this sort of flammable material was buried. And I'll talk to you soon. We've got new episodes on the way, and like I said, look out for perhaps another interview on this topic coming out quite soon. Oh, and apologies for the audio quality and lack of sort of production here. Like I said, this was a much more hastily put together episode, so I hope you can forgive me for that. Bye-bye.